So I've got an awful confession to make. It's something so shocking that by telling you, I'm probably going to alienate about 80% of you. On the other hand, the other 20% are going to totally get it. My awful confession is this. You ready? You're all sitting down. I have absolutely no interest in either football or cricket. Nor, if we're being totally honest, in any form of spectator sport. Now, our senior minister, Paul, is something of a sports fanatic, and he regularly draws very vivid and very pertinent sermon illustrations from the world of sport, and in particular from cricket and football. Unfortunately, I've got none of those. I've never been interested, despite the efforts of my sport-loving family. Does anyone remember the journalist Keith Dunstan back in the 60s and 70s in The Sun, I believe? Keith was well known for his abhorrence of Aussie rules, and in the late 60s he formed the Anti-Football League, whose emblem was a square football, if you wouldn't mind, Graham. Next one. The emblem for the Anti-Football League. They're still going, I believe. Someone once suggested to me that I should join the Anti-Football League. And I responded that I didn't actually care enough about football to be bothered with joining the Anti-Football League. So this lack of interest in football, in spectator sport, was a bit of a problem for me growing up, particularly in a footy-mad household, because it meant that during the winter months at least, our single black-and-white TV was fully dedicated to watching footy-related shows from Friday evening all the way through to Sunday afternoon. We had the Kevin Dennis football show on Friday night where they'd tell us who was going to win. We had the replay on Saturday, and then after that, I think it may have been the Kevin Dennis football show again, where they told us why they got it wrong on Friday night. And then on Sunday there was World of Sport and so on and so forth. It didn't matter if I was halfway through the latest episode of Star Trek. If something footy-related came on, the TV was flipped across to Channel 7 or to Channel 2. I just had to go and find something else to do. Things were only slightly better in the cricket season. My only consolation was that our whole family agreed on what to watch at 6:30 on a Sunday evening. So much so that aside from the footy, of course, it was the only excuse for dinner in front of the TV. And it was this, if you can play our video, please.
Walt Disney's Disneyland.
When you wish upon a star, makes no difference who you are.
Each week as you enter this timeless land, one of these many worlds will open to you. Frontierland. Tall tales and true from the legendary past. Tomorrowland, promise of things to come. Adventureland, the wonder world of nature's own realm. Fantasyland, the happiest kingdom of them all. Presenting this week, the Disneyland Story.
So who remembers that of a Sunday evening? We loved our Disneyland in the Huggins household. Now, Adventureland and Frontierland were okay. Learned a lot about American history in Frontierland. That's really important. Tomorrowland was much better. But what we lived for were the episodes from Fantasyland, normally a cartoon starring Donald Duck or Mickey Mouse or Goofy. Got a bit far. we lapped those ones up. But my absolute favourite character wasn't Donald or Mickey or Goofy. This guy, this was my favourite character. Who knows who this is? Uncle Scrooge, Scrooge McDuck. Scrooge McDuck was the richest duck in the whole world, and that's saying something. Scrooge didn't feature all that often in the cartoons, but when he did, I loved him. Scrooge was a notorious miser who kept all his wealth in a massive money bin. Thanks, Graham. And Scrooge would go to his money bin daily, and he'd play with his wealth, stacking it and counting coins, basking and even swimming in his loot. Scrooge was a fascinating character. Now, possibly because I was regularly outvoted when it came to TV content, I became an avid reader as a kid. And my favoured genre was science fiction, or it became science fiction. But I also loved historical fiction and mythology. Treasure Island was one of my favourites, with its images of buried treasure, enormous wealth hidden away in the ground, an X marking the spot, if only you had the right map. Tales of the Arabian Nights was another, and the story of Ali Baba and the 40 Thieves. Incredible wealth, gold and gems hidden away in a cave that could be only accessed if you knew the password, Open Sesame. So it looks like there's a bit of a theme developing, doesn't it? But I can assure you, I wasn't just obsessed with hidden riches. I actually read quite broadly. But there's no doubt that this idea of hidden treasure had some appeal for me. So our reading this morning is about treasure. Let's read it again. But we have this treasure in jars of clay to show that this all-surpassing power is from God and not from us. Now clearly we're not talking about the same sort of treasure that Uncle Scrooge had stashed away in his money bin, or that the pirates had buried in their treasure chest, or that the 40 thieves had stowed away in their cave. We're not talking about gold or gems or folding money. We're not talking about Bitcoin. So what is this treasure we have? We've got to go back a few verses to find out. Reading from Corinthians 4:4. The God of this age has blinded the minds of unbelievers so that they cannot see the light of the gospel that displays the glory of Christ, who is the image of God. For what we preach is not ourselves, but Jesus Christ as Lord, and ourselves as your servants for Jesus' sake. For God, who said, "Let light shine out of darkness," made this light shine in our hearts to give us the light of knowledge of God's glory displayed in the face of Christ. The treasure we have in these jars of clay is described as light, a light that shines in our heart. The knowledge of God's glory displayed in the face of Christ. The treasure we hold is the knowledge of Christ, who's the image of God. Our treasure is the gospel, the good news of Christ, his birth, his life among us, his death and resurrection for us, his example, his commands, his promises, and the amazing blessing of a life spent in relationship with him. Elsewhere, Jesus himself described the coming of the kingdom of heaven, the good news he came to proclaim and inaugurate, as a treasure. In Matthew 13, Jesus compares the good news of the kingdom of heaven to a treasure hidden in a field, which when found by a man caused him to go off and sell everything he had so he could own it. He also compares it to an incredibly valuable pearl, which again was valuable enough for a merchant to go and sell all he had so he could possess it. The gospel, the good news of Christ, is a treasure, God's treasure, entrusted to us. Is that how you see it? The reading we just read tells us that the God of this age has blinded the minds of unbelievers so they can't see. They can't see this treasure that we hold. Now, we get all theological and supernatural about who or what the God of this age is. But I don't think it's too much of a stretch to suggest that right here and now, the major manifestation of the God of this age can be found in society's craving for physical prosperity, for physical wealth. It's all the stuff we have and the desire for more stuff. It's comfort and the desire for more comfort. It's status, normally defined by how much you have, and the desire for greater status. The people all around us have their own treasure, a very tangible, physical treasure, and they have a need to acquire more of it, spurred on by the manufacturers, the media, and the Joneses next door. They've got their treasure, and they're preoccupied with acquiring more. Is it any wonder that they're blinded to the treasure we hold? But what does it mean that we've got this treasure in jars of clay? Well, I guess I'm not telling you anything you don't know when I say that the jars of clay are us. And you can find that imagery right through the Bible. As far back as the second chapter of Genesis, in verse 7, we read, "The Lord took a handful of soil and made a man. God breathed life into the man, and the man started breathing." We're a vessel formed from a handful of soil. Isaiah 45 says, "You are merely a clay pot shaped by a potter." Elsewhere in Isaiah, also in Jeremiah, Job, Lamentations, and Romans, we're referred to as clay vessels, the work of a potter. It's worth noting that in so many of these references, there's a strong overtone, spoken or unspoken, that says or infers the word merely. We're merely earthenware vessels. We're merely jars of clay, formed by the potter for his purposes. So the image here isn't of the beautiful and expensive earthenware vase or coffee pot you brought from the artisan potter on your last holiday. This is a humble, utilitarian, jack-of-all-trades container, which, of course, is exactly what the original hearers of our passage would have understood. No Royal Albert tea sets or Noritake dinnerware for these people. Not even a Bendigo pottery carafe. Simple earthenware pottery was cheap. It was everywhere. It was used for storing or holding everything, from food and water, right through to human waste. Nothing high and mighty about it. Our reading says that God stores this treasure in jars of clay in us to show that this all-surpassing power is from God and not from us. God's purpose isn't to display this amazing pot he's made. It's what's inside the pot that's important. But what if you really are an amazing pot? What if you're unusually attractive, or brilliantly clever, or incredibly successful? What's wrong with that? Doesn't that display God's glory? Doesn't that display the power of God's favour? So this morning I brought along this earthenware jar. Marg and I were given it as an engagement present. And believe it or not, back in the 70s, it was a pretty fashionable item. It used to stand on this pedestal in the corner of our living room until, of course, one day, the inevitable happened. A speeding child knocked it over, and now it looks like this. Earthenware is fragile. It's brittle. And no matter how beautifully made it is, a seemingly minor mishap can bring about disaster. We're the same, fragile, brittle. And when mishaps come, as they inevitably do, it's not our outer shell, the clay jar, that's going to ride out the bumps and pull us through. It's only the treasure inside that's going to do that. Now, our earthenware jar here still lives with us. It still performs a role and it still has pride of place, but it's in a very new setting. It now lies on its side, partly embedded in the soil as a feature in one of our garden beds. I'm not sure how the jar feels about its apparent fallen stature, but it's still important to us. Throughout Scripture, God uses flawed vessels to fulfill his purposes. Moses and Gideon both had massive inferiority complexes. Jacob was a con man. David was an adulterer and a murderer. But great things were achieved through all of them, through the power of God working in them. So let's go back to our opening examples. Scrooge McDuck's enormous money bin, the pirate's hidden treasure chest, the incredible wealth stowed away in the 40 thieves' cave. What do these treasures all have in common? Well, they're not doing anyone any good whatsoever. Here's this incredible wealth, and it's all locked away, or buried, or protected by a magical password. It sits there in its container and it does absolutely nothing for anyone. It's not even transformative for its owners. I mean, despite his enormous wealth, Scrooge McDuck won't spend a cent unless it stands to make him even more money. Despite their chest full of treasure that the pirates have just buried, they get back and they row back to their ship and they sail out again to plunder and pillage, to acquire more treasure to bury in the sand. Despite the riches in their cave, the 40 thieves go back out time and again to steal yet more riches, which they bring back to stow away in their cave. Enormous wealth, sitting there, hidden away, and it's not doing anyone any good whatsoever. In chapter 2 of John's first gospel, we read of Christ's first recorded miracle. If you could, Graham. On the third day, a wedding took place at Cana in Galilee. Jesus' mother was there, and Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. When the wine was gone, Jesus' mother said to him, "They have no more wine." "Woman, why do you involve me?" Jesus replied. "My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Nearby stood six stone water jars, the kind used by the Jews for ceremonial washing, each holding from 20 to 30 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, "Fill the jars with water." So they filled them to the brim. Then he told them, "Now draw some out and take it to the master of the banquet." They did so, and the master of the banquet tasted the water that had been turned into wine. He did not realize where it had come from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew. Then he called the bridegroom aside and said, "Everyone brings out the choice wine first, and then the cheaper wine after the guests have had too much to drink. But you have saved the best till now." So here are these six water jars. Nothing special about them at all, except now they're filled to the brim with the best wine. They're filled with the really good stuff. Sound familiar? Now, those jars could have stood there for the rest of the night with no one being the wiser, just six jars in the corner. But Jesus says, "Draw some out and take it to the master of the banquet." So they did, and he tasted it, and he said, "Wow, this is the best wine. This is the really good stuff." And from there, you can bet that the rest of the guests really enjoyed partaking of around 700 litres of the choicest wine they'd ever tasted. Now, I'm not going to get into debates about whether it was alcoholic or not. That's not important in this context. What's important is that Jesus and his disciples were at a joyful gathering, and the joy, in particular for the hosts, was about to be severely impacted. So what did Jesus do? He performed a miracle, his first recorded miracle, creating a type of treasure in six nondescript jars, enabling the joyful occasion to continue unabated. But as with the treasure he's placed in each of us, this one was intended to be shared. It served no purpose at all, sitting in the jars. But poured out of the jars and shared, it was a blessing to all of those gathered at the wedding feast. In Matthew 5, we read, "You are the light of the world. A town built on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on its stand, and it gives light to everyone in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others, that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven." The treasure we have within us is intended to be shared. If it's not, then like Scrooge's money bin, it's not doing anyone any good at all. Arguably not even ourselves, because it's meant to be transformative. The treasure, this light, this good news, it's meant to change us. And then it's meant to overflow from us to positively impact the lives of those around us. And the amazing thing about this treasure is that you can share and share and share, and you'll never run out. How awesome is that? So how do we go about sharing this treasure? Well, we could go around continually speaking about God's love at our workplace, at school pickups, with the cashier at Woolies. If you're a really gifted evangelist, that might work. But I suspect many of us wouldn't have a lot of success. But what does our reading say? Does it tell us to go out and proselytize? No. It says, let your light shine. It says that our good deeds will be what draws attention to the source of those deeds, the gospel, the good news that we've received, but which is still hidden from others. So maybe, rather than just talking about God's love, at least initially, we should be continually displaying God's love and its transformative power in us to all of those around us. We're called to be light because light is attractive. People are drawn to it. And in that space, in the context of a relationship with people who can see the manifestation of the good news in our own lives, maybe then we earn or we're given natural opportunities to share the source of this light, the treasure stored in these jars of clay. But that's actually a pretty tall order, isn't it? How can we be light all the time? How can we display love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control all the time? Maybe knocking on doors with a tract or inviting random workmates to recite the sinner's prayer with you is actually easier. Maybe it is. But is that how you let your light shine? Let's be frank. We are jars of clay, after all. We're fragile. We're brittle. We're prone to stress fractures, to chips and cracks, and even full-blown disintegration. And we're also chosen by God to be vessels for this amazing treasure he wants to share. He knows we're not perfect, but he still chose us. And as with Moses, Gideon, Jacob, and David, he says, "Go, and I'll be with you." Or as he said to Paul, "My grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness." Could the worship team join me up here, please? So when you're flagging, when the stress fractures are starting to appear, the is a couple of things I'd suggest. Firstly, take a look at your life. See if there's anything you need to change or even get rid of. Things that weigh you down, sap your joy, or maybe things that are just a pointless diversion from what really matters. Speaking from recent experience, I can say that I've just had a tilt at this. And as a result, I've divested myself of Facebook, at least for a time. And I can say it's one of the most positive things I've done in a while. Secondly, though, why not take a leaf out of Scrooge McDuck's book? Because he had at least one thing right. When you need refreshing, when you haven't got it in you to overflow anymore, why not pay a visit inside the money bin? Why not take a good, hard look at the treasure within the jar of clay? Do some exploring. Count the treasure. Bask in it. Swim in it. Seek out the pieces you haven't seen before or the ones you haven't fully appreciated before, and marvel at the beauty and the value of the treasure you've been given. But unlike Scrooge, allow the treasure to do the work it was intended for. Allow it to transform you, to refresh you, to fill your own jar to overflowing. Yes, the treasure is meant to be shared, but it's for you too. And when you've taken stock, when you've been refreshed, when you're renewed, and in awe once again of this amazing treasure that God has chosen to store in this unassuming, fragile clay jar that is you, how could you not start overflowing again? Jesus once said that if called upon, the rocks and stones would sing his praise. So as we finish, let's see how a bunch of clay jars can do. Thanks.